The novel coronavirus isn't the only thing that's been on a tear during this pandemic.
Housing sales have surprised many watchers, with more being bought than originally expected, and that's driven up costs in many markets across the country.
And now getting into the market or upgrading has become even further out of reach. I'm Adam Toy.
And I'm Dave McIver, and this is Why.
Housing is very tied up with my sense of security. And my mother was a renter her entire life, and I've seen sort of the insecurity that comes from that.
31-year-old Anita Min has been hoping to buy a home with her partner for years, but she's not seeing much they can afford. Even though the formerly red-hot Greater Vancouver area has cooled in recent months, it's still expensive. The average home price, more than $1.1 million.
I think the question of housing affordability plays a lot into whether or not to have kids, because housing is an expense. Children are an expense. Childcare is an expense. All of these things are related.
Historically low mortgage rates, a race for space, and a rush to get into the market ahead of tougher borrowing rules have all fueled a surge in home prices during the pandemic. And it's not limited to major urban centers. Prices are up about 30% across Canada, bringing bidding wars and buying frenzies to cottage country and smaller cities like Hamilton, Halifax, and Moncton.
$1 million for an average home in Vancouver and housing prices on the rise across the country. Is it time for Canada to become a country of renters?
If we were to push a lot of people right now into renting, there would be wealth inequality created by that. And that's a trend that you see in European cities like Germany, the Netherlands, like places where the majority of people rent. People just have a more difficult time saving that money into creating wealth because property is such an effective way to build wealth.
That's videographer Yute Lee.
My passion project is a YouTube channel called About Here, where I put a lot of my videos, video essays on any issue like that is related to, city politics and city policies. This is stuff like housing, to transit, to underground streams, just the fun geeky stuff around urban issues.
Your last couple of videos really caught my attention on your YouTube page, talking about some of the housing challenges that are in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And housing prices the housing market was surprisingly hot through the pandemic as people tried to change their living circumstances. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if you can share your perspective being in Vancouver. What's it like trying to live and find and afford housing, just keeping a roof over your head, in Canada's most populous West Coast city?
Oh my gosh. I mean, where to begin? Vancouver certainly seems to be definitely a city where the housing crisis does seem to hit a bit of a crux. Maybe I'll start. I know this might be a podcast, so it might be painful for your listeners, but so let's start with my room here. If you can, I'll describe it. It's like just like a small little shoebox, a basement suite that I rent here in Vancouver at a price that is probably too much for a space of this size. You mentioned the pandemic and how that's had an interesting effect on property prices, especially in, from my understanding, single family residential areas. But I would kind of remind people like the housing crisis has been here long before the pandemic, and in spaces, cities like Vancouver and Toronto, especially, property values were rising at an astonishing rate. In the last decade, I think 2016 was really quite a notable year for Vancouver. I mean, property prices have always been expensive here to some extent, but like I remember 2016 being like a year where it took like a double digit kind of jump. So, it's kind of nuts. And I'll admit for someone like myself, who's, kind of on the cusp now where I like I can definitely rent, somewhat comfortably, right? Putting a roof over my head is not like a huge struggle, but now that I'm, getting more, let's say older, I am thinking about should I be purchasing a property? Should I, will I ever be able to? And frankly, in a city like Vancouver, that dream seems more or less like a pipe dream, if I can put it that way. It really, I think Last time I checked, the property prices here on average in Metro Vancouver were about 11 times the average income of someone living in Metro Vancouver. And at that price, you know, unless you're taking out huge loans or you're getting a lot of help from mom and dad, you're kind of, you know, you're out of luck.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I'm looking at some numbers from the National Bank of Canada from early May, and it shows that the median home price for all dwellings, so this is condos and single detached and semi-detached, the median home price in Vancouver was $1.1 million. Meanwhile, the median annual income was $85,000 in Vancouver, which, as you said, that's, you know, 11-12x for that. And, you know, using National Bank of Canada's housing affordability monitor, you know, as you said, 2016, 2017, the number of months it would take to save a minimum down payment on a house in Vancouver jumped from, it looks like, around 70 to 360 months. So that's
sounds about right. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. No, it's great. Thanks for the reminder, Adam. It was a lot of fun talking about how depressing the housing market outlook is for people like me. But hey, you know what? I'm here for it. I'm here to talk about it.
You were saying that Vancouver's housing crisis has been around since before the pandemic hit last year. What have the elected representatives in City Hall done to help or hinder the problem?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Like from City Hall, okay, well, let me zoom out a little bit, because I'm, you know, with any issue like housing, like as soon as you go into like who's to blame or, you know, who's really pulling the levers for the housing market, you'll like everyone will disagree, or at least you'll half the room will disagree with you and the other half will be like, rah, rah, go Ute. So I'll start by saying that, there are many, many factors and actors behind the housing crisis here in Vancouver. And some could argue that it goes all the way back to, 1917 or 18, where the original city bylaw was made. But, talking from specifically City Hall's perspective, the local government's perspective, this is the case in cities, well across North America, is that cities do place a limit on the supply of housing that's being built. And that's through something known as the zoning bylaw. If you kind of shift your perspective on a bit, like the fact that there are zoning bylaws that do put limits on how much housing is produced in a city, that does create a limit on the supply, right? And it sends a signal to the market that this is a commodity that is a scarce resource to some extent, one that, you know, local governments regulate. So I think that local governments do play a key role in the housing crisis, in that they kind of hold the keys to they are the gatekeepers to more housing supply in cities. Here in Vancouver, it is kind of frustrating personally, because the city's strategy for for much of the last several decades has been to really concentrate housing developments into core areas that are uncontroversial. So these are former industrial sites. These are, you know, like waterfront industrial properties along like SkyTrain stations. And so these, you know, few properties, they'll like, you know, build like a 20, 30 story condominium. But then there's like 80% of the land in Vancouver that's still just single family houses. They never change in density. Thinking about it broadly, you think like, oh yeah, is that really like the best way we can add housing in a city, is to like just have these small points of incredible density and leaving everything else the same? I would disagree personally, but to some extent there are politics at play here, right? Like when there are established neighborhoods in Vancouver in these single family zones that are quite protective about the look and feel of their neighborhoods. And, you know, and I don't want to, invalidate those concerns. I think like development and change do bring a lot of, what's the word? Not insecurities, but like uncertainty, I suppose, to a neighborhood. But by kind of listening to those voices a little too much over the last several decades, you do end up with this pattern where you have housing concentrated in just select little areas and not much really being built anywhere else.
Yeah, and it's fascinating if you walk through Vancouver or even Toronto in some places where you've got these you know dozens of stories of high rise condos, and you walk two blocks down the street and you're down to single family, you know, 1-2 story houses, and it's a rather stark change, even just as being a pedestrian or riding your bike or driving through there.
Exactly. I think one of my favorite examples is actually in Toronto. If you're familiar with the neighborhood, it's called North York. Mm-hmm. It's right on top of a subway line. And it is, like as you described, like 30, 40 story buildings. And literally across the street, it's just like a sea of single family houses. It's really striking when you see it on a map, or I guess not on a map, but like kind of in satellite view on Google Maps, which is something you do if you're like an urban planning geek like me. If you don't mind me kind of bringing some terminology to this, like this phenomenon that we're talking about, it's called the missing middle. It really is sort of this phenomenon that happens in cities where there is a ton of development pressure that gets funneled into select core areas, effectively to sort of appease the local politics of the general more like affluent residential neighborhoods that you find in these single family zoned areas, which results in this kind of aesthetic of, you know, towers right next to single family houses.
So if home ownership is largely outside of the reach of the average income of your city, Vancouver, renting remains the option for most Vancouverites to live in that city. That begs the question of if every single person necessarily needs to own their own home, or can there be ways of thinking about renting as a way of life like in some European countries?
Many would say that this kind of obsession that North America has with using housing as a wealth creation asset is a huge driver behind our housing crisis, right? People here, I mean, kind of culturally almost to a certain extent, but also via government policy from the federal and provincial governments, people are encouraged to purchase their property and over time use that as their nest egg, right? A lot of boomers that bought houses in the 60s and 70s, those lucky people, I could have used another word, but they are millionaires now, right? Because they bought housing and they invested in it and they were able to create wealth. That's great for wealth creation, but when it comes to housing, I mean, housing isn't just, you know, an asset, right? It's not a stock for people. It's an essential need. It's a roof over your head. It's shelter. And I think what many have argued is that the more and more we've kind of treated housing as this sort of wealth creation asset, this stock, it's created like a bit of a frenzy around housing and a lot of speculation, a lot of treating housing not so much as like an essential need, but as, you know, a speculative investment. This is where we have, you know, shadow flippers coming in that just buy a condo pre-sale and then sell it before it's even built. It's where, you know, many would say like foreign investors come into the picture. This is where REITs and banks, you know, are buying up property, right? Like it's become a very good investment. But at the end of the day, housing is like an essential need. And the main difference between owning and renting a house, to get back to your original question, is that people who rent do not see housing as an investment. When you rent, you're paying for a service. I like to describe it as like when you rent, you're treating your housing like a gym membership, right? Mm-hmm. You're just seeing that money go out the door, but you are getting a service in return. You're able to live in a place. And the argument has been that if the majority of people are just treating housing as a service, they're not treating it as a wealth creation asset, you might end up stabilizing the housing market. An example that I kind of point to in a video I've made is Germany, where more than 50% of the country rents their housing in places like Berlin. They, I think it's something like 81% of the city are renters. They have a relatively stable housing market. The general population isn't as interested in purchasing their homes. It's not sort of seen as, you know, one of the things you have to do in life. And as a result, there is a lot more progressive policies around renting in Germany, supports for renters, protections for renters. And that's a whole other can of worms of like whether those protections for renters are a great thing or not. But, you know, like I think that you kind of really just see a different dynamic around housing in countries like that you know, and others in Europe for sure.
As you were describing the different ideas behind or the different perspectives on housing, is the speculative part of it. To me, it's as you were describing it, it kind of sounded like how Bitcoin is being used as a speculative asset, right? Like it was originally put in as a, or you know, conceived as right. as this currency, but right. now people are treating it as a speculative asset. It's jumped from like, you know, single thousands of dollars in value to right. tens of thousands of dollars of value and drops again. Now that's across the world and many different players in that field, but that's one example of a speculative asset. Meanwhile, for this utility, this right. service you're talking about, I'm thinking rideshare, where people, you know, can get transportation to where they need to go as if it's a car, but not have to own the car. They just pay for the services somebody drives around.
I think you bring up a couple of great examples. I think, yeah, with Bitcoin, it is absolutely similar to housing in the fact that it was conceived as a utility and now is being used as a speculative asset. And then, yeah, with Uber and Lyft, and with it's interesting. Like yeah, it makes a lot more sense, I think, for people to take, you know, services like Uber and Lyft, because, you know, buying a car is not an investment, you know, buying right. a car, it's a depreciating asset, right? So, you know, people like, so the car industry doesn't have like, all, like nobody's like buying tons of vehicles overseas because they think they're going to sell it later at a higher price. Like it just doesn't work that way. I think like to your point, like if more and more people treated housing that way, you know, it would definitely stabilize the housing market to some extent. You know, I think like, frankly, is like housing is always going to have some amount of like speculation and wealth, you know, creation, you know, tied to it. Like at the end of the day, like what really is creating the value is the land, right? Like if you own land there, it is, you know, kind of by definition, almost like a scarce resource.
They're not making any more of it. That's how the saying goes, right?
Last time I checked, I mean, maybe there's some magma plumes in the Pacific Ocean that creates an island every now and then. But like, yeah, other than that, like we have a limited quantity, and in cities where the, you know, like especially like Vancouver with geographic constraints, like there is a limited quantity. It's always like if people buy land, there's going to, the value will be there and it will increase. But I think when it comes to housing and, you know, a roof over your head, this sort of, interplay between local governments kind of restricting the supply, but then culturally and federal governments and provincial governments really incentivizing people to buy their housing, does kind of create this like vicious circle of like just the prices going higher and higher and people treating it increasingly and increasingly like a Bitcoin.
The latest video on your YouTube page is called "Can We Rent Our Way Out of the Housing Crisis?" You've touched on some of those points right now, but I want you to give away the ending. And I encourage everybody to go and watch it, but can we rent our way out of this housing crisis?
Okay, spoiler alert. I feel conflicted. I think to some extent, yes. I think if to some extent, if we encourage and provide incentives and policy protections for more renters and kind of shift away from an ownership society to more of a renting society, that has an effect of cooling the housing market. And I could see that if, you know, the federal government, you know, sort of took its foot off the, you know, the gas pedal of home ownership a bit, you know, just a little bit, you know, that could help our housing market be, you know, in the long term, be a bit more stable. Not even going to say more affordable. I'm going to say stable, because that's what we're really looking for here. We like by with all this speculation, like, you know, the other sort of foot that drops in that is like, you also have housing crashes, right? Like you have like huge increases, but you also have huge crashes. So I think that there's my, you know, long-winded answer, sorry, to that question. But with this video, I do touch on another side of the story that I think is equally relevant. And to me, ended up making me kind of quite conflicted about this whole issue, which is kind of surprisingly, the issue of wealth inequality. You know, like we talked about it, like home ownership traditionally has been a very effective vehicle to building wealth here in North America. And we have a very strong middle class that owns housing that are, you know, going to become millionaires in a city like Vancouver. you know, by kind of, if we were to push a lot of people right now into renting, that there would be wealth inequality created by that. And that's a trend that you see in European cities like Germany, like the Netherlands, like places where the majority of people rent, people just have a more difficult time saving that money into creating wealth, because property is such an effective way to build wealth. Not having that option, you know, means you kind of, people just don't have as many resources to creating their own wealth. And in the long run, that does tend to create wealth inequality. In Germany, you know, a lot of these like kind of progressive places in Europe, they have like a really wealthy aristocratic class of people that own a lot of the land, and the majority of the country rents and doesn't really pass on a lot of wealth to future generations.
This is Why is produced by me, Dave McIver, and Adam Toy. It's a national radio show and a podcast.
You can reach us by email, thisiswhy@globalnews.ca, and on Twitter @thisiswhy.
If you like what you hear and want to hear more, make sure you subscribe to This Is Why so you never miss an episode. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And if you like what you're hearing, tell a friend.
Thanks for listening. Wear a mask and get vaccinated. We'll see you soon.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.